The National Broadcasting Company brings you Voices and Events, the living record of history this week, recorded by the NBC News and Special Events Department. You'll hear President Truman and John Foster Dulles, Ernest Bevin, the Queen of England, General Eisenhower, and Grandma Moses. These and many others. You'll hear the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, here is your editor for Voices and Events, James Fleming.
Said Harry Truman this week, "The campaign always begins on Labor Day." And there was no doubt about it if you listened to the president's fighting speech that day.
People want fair laws for labor. The selfish interests are against these laws because they mistakenly fear that their profits will be reduced. So they call that statism. Well, we don't care what they call it. The people want a fair program for the farmers, including an effective price support system. So they call this socialism. Well, we don't care what they call it.
You'd hardly expect those words to go unchallenged by the Republicans, and they weren't. GOP leader Senator Kenneth Wherry gave a listen to the president and shot right back.
President Truman preaches freedom and independence for the individual, but he practices socialism, and all his disclaimers cannot erase the fact that the measures he has submitted to the Congress inevitably would make your government your master and not your servant, as it should be. The president calls attacks upon his spendthrift, socialistic proposals scare words, but his actions speak louder than his words.
The political scene noted one good solid fact this week. No doubt now how the race shapes up for the U.S. Senator from the state of New York. Of course, it was doubtful for a while because last July, Governor Thomas E. Dewey named to a Senate vacancy John Foster Dulles. And NBC's George Hicks asked,
"Well, Mr. Dulles, will you run as a Republican against the Democratic candidate in the special election next November?"
"I have no present intention of running in the election in September."
"Then this will be your only time in the Senate?"
Presumably, only this session, which runs until December.
But it's a politician's prerogative to have a change of mind. So, to face former New York Governor Herbert Lehman, the Democratic candidate, it will be John Foster Dulles.
"I have cooperated with the Roosevelt and the Truman administration for over 5 years in foreign policy, but I've always brought to bear an independent judgment. The administration needs that in the Senate. I have decided to be a candidate for another term in the Senate because I believe that there is a job there that can be done by a Republican and that can't be done by a Democrat."
A colorful man is the Vice President of the United States. And newsmen this week continued to hound him for details on his reported romance.
The eligible Mr. Barkley had a set-to with the press in St. Louis when they snapped him dancing with attractive Mrs. Carlton Hadley. But in Chicago, the Veep was more affable when he talked of picnics and romance to NBC reporter Len O'Connor.
"Well, now, Mr. Barkley, I think I better hand you the microphone because I have to ask you if your friend from St. Louis is coming here to the picnic."
"I don't know. I understand that Colonel and Ms. Arvey have invited her, but I have no information as to whether she will be here or not."
"Well, that's a real high-class picnic. A lot of fun, Hannah."
"I know that. And I have no doubt that she would get a big thrill out of it. She enjoys things like that, and I know would enjoy that. But whether she can come, I don't know."
Well, thank you very, very much, sir."
"Of course, you understand I'd have no objection to it."
And youngsters could take a lesson in the art of living as a sprightly old lady turned 89 this week. Her name is Anna Mary Robertson Moses, but you know her as Grandma Moses. Chances are, in last year's batch of Christmas cards, there was more than one from a painting by Grandma. She's perhaps our foremost modern primitive, as the artists say. She celebrated her 89th birthday this week, recalling again how she began to paint in earnest at the age of 75, as she said, to pass away the time. Now, her pictures bring $1,500 and up. Last time she was in New York City to talk with the public, NBC reporter W.W. Chaplin paid a call on Grandma Moses.
"How many pictures do you paint now, Grandma, in a year, say?"
"Well, I really don't keep track of them."
"You're painting all the time?"
"Nearly all the time. I like to start 4 at a time. Therefore, I save paint, save time. As a child, I used to paint. I used to swipe my father's paints and paint beautiful, lambskin scenes, as my brother said I called them. And the more redder they were, the better.
Finally, I asked if Grandma Moses' visit here might result in some city scenes, and she said...
No, it don't appeal to me.
As picture material.
As any material.
A street corner in Camden, New Jersey, became the news center of the USA this week. In a fleeting nightmare moment, death, sudden, stark, unreasoned, took a shocking toll.
15, perhaps 20 minutes, and the cold fury of a twisted mind and a blue steel pistol had claimed 12 lives. A 13th died later. The details are now history. How the strange Harold Unruh stalked his neighbors, squeezing off his shots with incredible accuracy, picking his targets almost at random. A firm hand will enter in the records that this was one of the greatest mass murders in criminal history. Others will remember for different reasons. But at 32nd Street and River Road, they don't forget so soon. William R. Wilson of KYW Philadelphia walked along River Road. 6 days ago, a silent, savage killer paced the same route. Here, the drugstore where two died, the barber shop, and the tailor shop, scene of another deadly call.
May I have your name, sir?
Thomas the Greeno.
And do you operate this cleaning and tailoring shop?
Yes, I do.
Where were you on this particular morning, Mr. Legrino?
I went to an errand in Gloucester, and I came back within about 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what was going on. I ran in my tailor shop and walked to the toward the back and turned around and found my wife. It could have been within 15 minutes before I got back.
And what was her name?
Helga.
Mm-hmm. How long had you been married?
2.5 months.
For Thomas Legrino and the other parents, children, and relatives of those who died without knowing why, this week was one of greatest tragedy.
For another American community, this week was a time for taking stock and examining some basic beliefs in our democracy.
Peekskill is one of our more attractive suburbs here in New York. It's in Westchester County, just up the Hudson River. On these past two Sundays, things have happened in Peekskill that are hard to believe possible in 1949. Paul Robeson went there to sing, but there was more hate than music in the air. This week, days after the trouble, we went back to Peekskill, back to get a portrait of a town where violence ruled last Sunday. It's the noon hour now. The sky's overcast. An occasional drop of rain lies glistening on the storefront awning. The NBC recording unit is set up on a main street. Women are hurrying about their shopping. A few men stand lounging about. Working people, businessmen, housewives, some youngsters. So, you listen.
Yes, I was in the riot. I threw stones. The reason why is because other people threw them, and I thought I ought to follow, too.
He was a boy in his teens. This girl was older.
I was there Sunday, and I was also there the Saturday before. And I threw rocks because I feel these people were really looking for trouble.
By this time, a lot of folks were anxious to give their opinions. So you listen.
My name is Richard Sniffen. I come from Buchanan, New York, which is located about a mile south of Peekskill. Well, I don't think it's left any mark. Peekskill's always been a peaceful community.
My name is Mrs. Earl O'Connor, and I live on Highland Avenue in Peekskill. I feel as if the tension is greater now than it was last week. I mean, that's a topic of conversation wherever you go. And even on the buses and in beauty parlors and in the stores, that's all you hear talked about is that riot of last Sunday.
My name is Esther Pickard of Shrub Oak. I don't believe. I know that people are hot now and that things are tense and so on, and there's a lot of talk and all that, but I believe this will all die down, and it has left no mark on Peekskill. Peekskill will carry on as it always has.
My name is Gene Levinson. I run a small newspaper here in town called the Peekskill Shopper. I was at both Robeson affairs, the first one and the second one, and I personally think that it was a disgraceful affair, and I don't think it helped the community in any way, shape, or form.
My name is Adolf Grossman, and there's not a bad reflection that leaves here. Some people think it starts anti-Semitism in Peekskill. I'm a Jew, and I've been coming up here, and I know it was mistreated anywheres. But gossip starts that way, and only bad feature is that the communists got $1 million publicity out of this, which they should have paid for.
These are the voices of the citizens of Peekskill. Some are still afraid and angry.
My name is Alice Cohn. I live at 936 Divin Street, Peekskill, New York. I fully believe that the demonstration here last Sunday was disgraceful to the town. It did nothing for it but just make it a ridicule for the entire United States. The fact that Robeson is a communist or isn't a communist is not the issue. The issue is that he wanted to have a concert here, a concert that he should have had because that is his privilege as a person living in the United States. They're told that it's communism we must be afraid of, but it isn't communism so much as it's fascism in this country.
You move on now through Peekskill streets to Miller's Tavern. It's a small place. Working men gather here for a glass of beer or hamburger. Rather dark inside. Long bar along the left wall.
My name is Gus Miller. I'm a bartender here at Miller's Restaurant in Peekskill, New York. The people that come in here, I hear them talk. They come in to eat and drink. If Robeson should come back for another one, I think the same thing would happen all over again.
Over in the corner, two men interrupted a game of checkers. One of them, Joe DeBarry. The other, Carmen Piccarello.
Well, it affected me like a little flame. And the more I marched, the bigger the flame got. Right now, I feel just about the same way talking about it. I'm getting all tied up, and I'm burning up inside.
I am Joe DeBarry. I've been in Peekskill 27 years, and 41 years ago I rented to Scranton from Italy. I went out there Saturday night. I was parading with the gang. I was way ahead of it, way ahead of the parade. Yes, I was, because I don't like to see a people come over and ruin this town. But this town is clean town. And besides that, the country is good country. If they ever live on the other side themselves, they know what it is to go without bread because they had it. And now that they got it, what they want over here, they still got to make trouble for us people. May God help them when they come over here again.
Now you drive out the road where the trouble began. Here, screaming crowds pelted stones on buses and cars, carrying thousands home from the Robeson concert. Over the rise is the meadow where the concert was held. Here, a stone wall was ripped up by the mob for ammunition, and you talk to a woman who lives nearby.
I'm Mrs. Warren Trim. I live approximately a quarter of a mile from the scene of the last riot. I hope that we never have another one. I have three small children, and it isn't anything for children to witness.
The concert was held last Sunday at the Hollowbrook Country Club. Here is Stephen Zago, who owns the land and rented it out for the concert. He tells of attempts to burn his house, of threatening phone calls. And we asked, did you consider moving away from Peekskill?
No, I didn't. It's really very sickening, and I'm greatly concerned about my family. My wife is extremely frightened to that extent that she became hysterical, and she just wouldn't stay under no circumstances in the house any longer. So... Since Sunday night, we were staying with friends. But on the other hand, I'm also very mad about what happened, and I really would like to fight it out.
Well, there you have Peekskill, 1 week later. There was one man this week with some very definite thoughts on the passions that divide some of our society into extremes of right and left. His name is General Dwight Eisenhower. And he spoke like this on fundamental principles of our democracy.
First, that individual freedom is our most precious possession. Second, that all our freedoms, personal, economic, social, political, freedom to buy, to vote, to worship, to gather in a convention or join in mutual association, each is an indispensable part of a single whole. Destruction of any inevitably leads to the destruction of all.
You are listening to Voices and Events, the living record of history compiled by NBC's News and Special Events Department, the actual voices of the people who made the news this week as they made it. Now, from the NBC Newsroom in New York, here again is James Fleming.
Pennant fever gripped the nation this week as Major League Baseball moved toward the World Series. You know, baseball is one thing not common to the English-speaking world. Our national pastime leaves the people of England puzzled and perplexed. But then, they've got cricket over there, which leaves us puzzled and perplexed. Just to call time out in the middle of the baseball season, we asked NBC London correspondent Merrill Muller, what's the story on this game called cricket?
Cricket, the great English national pastime, is now in full swing over here. And to an American looking at a cricket field, things are rather confusing. In the first place, you've got to imagine a complete outfield without any bases. In the middle of the outfield are two home plates. The two home plates are required because there are two batsmen in every cricket game and two pitchers. You see, it's a little confusing, but it gets more so. Now, here's what an English cricket commentary sounds like during a crack match at Lord's between a pickup team called the Gentlemen and another team of professionals called the Players.
For those who just come into your lunches, incidentally, the gentleman made 267 this morning. Carter caught all the first three, and pretty good catches two of them were. And we are going to see another over from Brown, bowling from the nursery end, where he's been hammering away and bowling really very well indeed for the last hour and a half. Now he's coming up to bowl to Evans, and he hits him down. I think he's caught him, probably. No, he hasn't. A rather lucky stroke by Evans. And there's that amount of byplay going on now. There was nearly an overthrow. Evans was always pulling everyone's leg, goes down the wicket, and Brown rather humorously tries to stop him getting back. And Brown's going to bowl now with a slip and a gully and a silly mid-off. Hutton was caught hooking, caught off his glove by Carter, a very good catch at leg slip. John Langridge was caught gliding, also by Carter off Bailey, both those off Bailey. Robertson was caught pushing, you might say, by Carter in front of the wicket this time, a short leg off Brown. Graveney was bowled by Bailey. Rather good one. My goodness, he's very nearly got him that time.
In case you heard any reference to luncheons or teas, let me assure you that cricket does not stop for meals in the sense that the game plays up to a tea break and it plays up to a luncheon break and resumes play immediately after both meals, and that matches last for days and days and days.
Still going strong in Washington this week was the argument over more aid for Chiang Kai-shek. Heading the small bloc of senators actively urging more money for the crumbling nationalist regime in China was California Republican Senator Noland. He phrased his argument like this.
For 4 years, the danger signals have been visible in the Far East. General MacArthur has seen them and reported the facts to this government. Despite the aid and comfort which the Department of State has given to the communist forces of China, there is, I believe, a great reservoir of goodwill towards non-communist China throughout the United States. Supervised aid, as in Greece, given to the non-communist forces in China now, may ultimately prevent half the world's population, a billion people, from falling prey to international communism, which is on the march.
But the majority view in Congress was with the administration. Tacked on to a foreign aid bill was a compromise fund for the nationalists that the president could use as he wanted to. Senator Tom Connally, the Foreign Relations Committee chairman, explained the reluctance to aid Chiang Kai-shek.
The United States has always been a friend to China. The committee is friendly to China. However, it must be borne in mind that we have already, within the recent past, given to China more than $2 billion. It must be remembered that Chiang Kai-shek, who is head of the national government, resigned as premier and as head of that government and repaired to Formosa. He took with him $300 million in gold bullion, the property of the nationalist government. The committee was not disposed to vote any money to be turned over to Chiang Kai-shek.
The almighty dollar and the not-so-mighty pound sterling dominated this week's happenings in Washington. The time came for the best financial brains to get together and put the sagging British economy back on the road to prosperity. Arriving in the United States were Britain's financial chief, Sir Stafford Cripps, and Ernest Bevin, the foreign secretary. Bevin pointed up the importance of the economic discussions like this.
If we make progress in the political world, as we've done in the recent months, in the great measures that have been adopted in the Atlantic Pact, in the Brussels Treaty, in the European recovery, and in all these great democratic measures, then we must, at the same time, get rid of the constant crisis difficulty arising from maladjustment and disequilibrium in the economic and financial field. In that spirit, we are going to undertake our task in meeting the governments of the United States and Canada.
Yes, Canada, too, is a party to these talks in Washington. Voices and Events called on Canada's finance minister, Douglas Abbott, and we asked, what's required to cure this economic sickness?
What is required at the present stage, in our view, is to face our problems realistically and with understanding of each other's difficulties. I am convinced that these discussions in Washington will result in our making real progress towards the solution of these vital problems.
Putting it more specifically, many are saying the cure for Britain lies in more and better priced goods for export to the dollar countries. And none realize this so much as the British themselves. For example, an industrial exposition in Glasgow this week, a proud showing of what British industry can do, and on hand for the occasion was Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth of England.
My visits to Glasgow always leave me with happy memories. Scotland can be proud of her industries, and this is indeed a proud way of showing them to the world. And now I wish every success to the Scottish Industries Exhibition of 1949 and have great pleasure in declaring it open.
Britain's aviation industry was no laggard. This week saw demonstrations of the very latest in British planes.
First came the new giant, the Brabazon, world's largest civilian land plane. Its 8 engines can carry 120 passengers nonstop from London to New York. Listen as the pilot and ground crew talk by radio on the very first flight of the mammoth Brabazon.
Matic 2 to Matic 1, I'm just going to go forward a little bit slowly to make sure the tow brakes work, and then I'm going to set CB on all engines and let her go a bit.
Okay, Bill, I'll let you know how to go to the airport.
Roger.
Next, military craft in action, many of them with still secret features. Here's how the BBC described the British Air Exposition for its listeners.
And now, from the roof of the control tower, some new sounds out of the sky. The sounds of planes which most of you have not had a chance of seeing or hearing. And first, the biggest helicopter in the world, the 24-seater Sierra Air Horse. And now Britain's first jet bomber. And here comes the Canberra, which has just taken off, turning and diving at the field at high speed. And now, here she is, flashing round just above the crowd.
This week, death ended the career of the last of the romantic composers. His name, Richard Strauss.
You are listening to the opening bars of Don Juan, the tone poem by Richard Strauss. At his home in Germany, the ailing composer died this week at the age of 85. His music enriched the world for more than 60 of those 85 years, till Eulenspiegel, the operas Salome and Der Rosenkavalier were among his better-known works. On learning of the great composer's death, a great conductor came forward with a final tribute to Richard Strauss. The words of Sir Thomas Beecham.
Although we all have known for a little while that Richard Strauss has been in bad health, it is still something of a shock to hear that he is dead. The last great German has now left us. What a host of memories. Going back over 60 years, does not the name of this last great master of the romantic school of music conjure up
Truly, as was said of Sophocles, an old man eloquent.
School bells will be ringing across the land, and for many youngsters, schools will be in the same sorry state they were last year.
We heard this time last year about teacher shortages, money shortages, and all manner of shortages in our school system. To get this year's story, Voices and Events called on the U.S. Office of Education and Commissioner Earl McGrath.
American education, I am convinced, faces its most critical year in 1949-50. Basic to education of any quality are classrooms, teachers, and the tools to teach. Yet the nation is badly in need of all three. Thousands of children across the nation will attend makeshift classrooms this year. The education of many boys and girls will be shortchanged because of overcrowding and half sessions required to accommodate the largest enrollments in educational history.
There's many a teacher or former teacher to say that impossibly low salaries are thinning out their ranks. But we asked a very new teacher why he's going in for it. He's Dale Goltz of Mankato, Minnesota. He's 21. And this week he taught his first class in high school English. At station KYSM, he told why he went into the teaching business.
Well, 4 years ago when I entered college, I hadn't decided on a definite vocation, but I had made up my mind that I wouldn't be a teacher. Last Tuesday morning, I started my first day of teaching. You probably wonder what happened. Well, maybe this isn't the most practical way to choose a career, but during the last 4 years, I started to realize how important teaching really was. One thing I did find was that I'm not alone in my thinking. I remember when a bunch of us would get together to talk about teaching, most of them felt that there was really something to be done. I just hope we keep feeling that way and do it.
What about buildings and classrooms? The elders of Saginaw, Michigan, well remember what happened last spring when, in a special election, the voters of Saginaw decided against a bond issue to pay for new schools. The youngsters were indignant, as newsman Jack Parker found out when they stormed into station WSAM.
Wait a minute, I want...
No school, no school!
What's that, a new school?
No school, no school! We'll see how until we get one. Yeah.
What's behind this demonstration?
Well, we want new schools.
Well, there's no new school this year, but when it comes time to vote again, parents are going to remember how their kids feel. And how does a very young boy feel about going to school for the first time? Listen.
I'm anxious to learn how to read and write. I could just print. And I'm just learning a little bit by sounds. But now I'm really going to be learning how to read and write. That's what I can't wait to do.
That was the voice of quiz kid Melvin Miles giving one reason for going to school. On a higher level, we found still another. At the University of Wisconsin, a pert co-ed came to the microphone to say...
Well, if you don't use my name, I'll frankly admit that the only reason I came to college was to get myself a man.
This has been Voices and Events, the living record of history this week, compiled by the News and Special Events Department of the National Broadcasting Company, the actual voices of the people who made the news as they made it. Your editor has been James Fleming. This is Robert Warren speaking and inviting you to listen at this same time next week for Voices and Events.